Welcome back to Hope for the Caregiver. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is the program for you as a family caregiver, and we're so glad that you're with us. HopeForTheCaregiver.com. HopeForTheCaregiver.com. If you want to learn more about the program, be on the program. Send us a note through the website, and we'll call you if you want to from the program. Whatever's on your heart, send it to us. Let us know what you're thinking about, what's going on with you. You know, you've heard me on this program a lot talk about the importance of doing things as you caregive, that you don't put your life on hold, that you're constantly advancing who you are as a person, whether it's whatever you love, music, gardening, your work, whatever. You don't put your life on hold. You may have to be creative and you may have to suspend a few things, and that's okay. But you don't put you on hold. And I'm always encouraging people to find out what makes their heart sing, what they enjoy doing. And then I like to find interesting stories of people who have done just that and are living it and just doing it. And that brings me to my guest today. He is an award-winning author named Ethan Burroughs, and he's got a book that he published in 2021 called Messianic Reveal. And the second one has just come out. It's called Writ Reveal. He's got a third one that's going to come out next year. It's part of a trilogy. And we went to the same high school, same small town in South Carolina, so I thought I'd invite him on. It's a little bit of a departure from what I normally do, but I've read the books. They're fascinating books. And so I wanted to have him on the program. Since we both are from South Carolina, you know, we can understand each other. And we don't need subtitles for each other. No. But I am glad to have him here with us. Ethan, welcome to the program.
Peter, it's good to be here. I'm really delighted to be on your show.
Well, this book, you sent me copies of this book, and I poured through them and read them. Just gripping stories. And they're nonfiction books. They're novels. They're thriller, action, spy, all of the above. But you have a different twist on this, and this is why I felt like it was interesting, and I like to read, and I love books like this, and I like history. This book brings something different. You have a very extensive background overseas in the Middle East, some things we can't talk about, and so we won't talk about them. But a very extensive background, and you decided to use that background and write a story more than just a fun story and tale and a spy novel. You also had some things you wanted to accomplish in this. So give us a little bit of the background of what brought you to even write this book, this series of books.
Well, thank you, Peter. That's a great intro, and I'm really excited to be here. As you referenced, you know, some people, you know, have their lives on hold. My life has been on hold on for about 25 years. I'm former military. I worked in military intelligence as an Arabic linguist back in the 90s. And then and that opened up a lot of doors for me as a civilian. And I spent some serious time living, traveling, and raising my family in the Middle East, from countries ranging from Saudi Arabia to Jordan to Tunisia, Kuwait. And then also spent a lot of time in Israel, the Palestinian territories, Syria before the war broke out there, and even some tough time in Iraq. And that's really fed a sense of wonder in me, kind of a wonder in, like, what is the connection? What is the connection that we as Americans have to the region that gave us our faith, the region that we've invested so much political capital in over the last 70, 80 years, and in the last few decades, a lot of blood and treasure has gone into this region through wars and through our engagement. And I've had the great, great pleasure of being in the region and meeting with emirs and kings and influential businessmen and women and entrepreneurs and Islamic clerics, Christian clerics, Jewish clerics, and even some refugees. I've spent time in refugee camps and things like that. You know, they change your heart. They change your mind. They change who you are once you've seen how the other side lives. And when you've seen what the impact, whether it's positive or negative, of U.S. policy on people in various hotspots in the world. And I've even have the distinction of having met a terrorist I didn't know it at the time. If I'd known that 3 days later, the young man I met in Iraq would blow himself up and kill, I think, 4 Iraqi soldiers, I would have loved to go back in time and say something to him to change his mind. I didn't. But all of that, my experiences, my expertise, my engagements, my interviews that are with hundreds of people, the people I've had in my homes or people with whom I've dined with in their homes, you know, breaking bread is a real thing in the Middle East. And all that fed into kind of, again, a sense of wonder. And I really wanted to kind of understand the political dynamic that we have in the Middle East, but also where the intersection of faith and politics is with religion, and where you know, religion and politics actually cause the greatest friction.
Well, one of the things is I got and dug through your books, as I was stunned by the scope of history that you covered in these books. And I haven't read your third one yet. That comes out. When does that come out?
I'm hoping it'll be released in the spring, early spring of next year, of 2023.
Okay.
It's called Babylon Reveal. And got a surprise for you. There's Prophecy Reveal is nearly complete as well. So there's
the fourth
one from trilogy to we have 4 books in progress now.
That's astonishing. Well, it opened my eyes a lot to the historical scope of what you're bringing to this. This is not just a spy novel that we see kind of compiled from the outside looking in. You're from the inside looking out and looking in at all at the same time. You've actually lived it. And I asked you one point, I said, what is true and not true in this book? Because it's a novel and it's meant to be entertaining. It's meant to be a fun story to tell. You wanted to tell a story, but you had some things you wanted to accomplish in this. And I said, well, what's true and what's not? I couldn't figure out which part was fiction. And I remember, you remember what you told me?
Yep.
What did
it's
you say?
The true parts. It's the true parts that are the most terrifying.
And they are. I mean, it's like, yep. Wow. And I didn't know this, but you dug into stuff that nobody's ever written about, at least not anybody from the West. And I think that was kind of your point, wasn't it?
That's exactly right. My protagonist in the book, Clayton Haley, I write him with a sense of wonder that like the Connecticut Yankee must have had in the proverbial, court of King Arthur. But what I do is I take Clayton Haley back through some history. In the first book, some fairly recent history. In the second book, some ancient history. In the third book, even more ancient history. That's another conversation for another day. But one of the things that came to me as I started doing some research, and I did not intend to sit down and write a novel. I'd never written a novel before. What I intended to do was kind of build a chronology that I could share with my children about, the very region that they grew up in. But as I started with dates, I studied history. I went to the University of South Carolina. I studied history. I love history. And I just started kind of keeping a track of dates that people are familiar with. 1917, 1918, roughly the end of World War I, the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and their grip on the greater region for 400 years. And then you fast forward to 1948, the establishment of the State of Israel. Then you go to 1967, the Six-Day War, the Munich Olympics in 72, 73, and then you go up to 1979, and you have the ransacking of our embassy in Tehran by a bunch of...
Well, and let me stop you right there, because this is what gripped me, is that, we tend to have a very short memory here in our country. I mean, it's hard for us to remember 2 years ago, much less 200 years ago. But in the Middle East, the memory is long, and you've connected the dots from all of these events in a novel, in a fictional work, but all the events are real, and you connected the dots historically accurate. I mean, it's not like you just made all these things up. All of these things are connected. All of this leads us to where we are as a country and why this is still on the front page of every paper and on the evening news of every evening news is something to do with the Middle East. Is that a fair assessment?
I think so. I think that we tend to come up with convenient answers and silos where we keep this silo for this issue, this silo for this issue, this silo for another issue, and we don't naturally connect them. And I wanted to connect them in this book, especially Messianic Reveal. I wanted to understand them. I'm writing the book, but I felt like I was in the front seat watching this happen. And, you know, as we get to 19, I'll give you a perfect example. You know, I think people have a rough understanding of the Sunni world versus the Shia world when it comes to Islam. I think people have a general understanding that, you know, when you talk about the Arab Muslim world, you're talking about 300 million people. When you're talking about the greater Muslim world, you're talking about 1.5 billion. It's a huge, you know, there are more Muslims outside of the Arab world than there are in the Arab world. And I wanted to connect some things really surrounding two signature events. You know, I just mentioned the ransacking of our embassy in Tehran, 1979. Traumatic event for the Americans. And we have neatly packaged that as, you know, and we've had this grudge match with the Iranians ever since 1979. They held our people for 444 days. Well, what people don't know is that 2 weeks late, 2 weeks after they ransacked our embassy in Tehran, there was a Messianic cult, and this is where I get the name of my book, Messianic Reveal, comes from the arrival of a Messianic cult led by a guy by the name of Muhammad Abdullah Qahtani and his cousin/brother-in-law, Juhayman al-Otaibi. And they led a cult of former National Guardsmen from Saudi Arabia, and they took over the holiest site of Islam. They took over the Grand Mosque in Mecca. And again, this is important. 1.5 billion people prostrate themselves every single day, 5 times a day, and pray to this place as part of the tenets or the pillars of Islam. Okay. And it was bloody. I mean, and they held this for 2 weeks. The Saudi National Guard had to, you know, rip them out of there with the help of Pakistani commandos and French commandos who had to hastily convert to Islam because you could not have non-believers on the holiest ground of Islam. So they went in, they rousted them out of the Vatican of the Muslim world. And it was brutal. You had gunfire, machine gun fire, sniper fire, grenades. You had chemical warfare used against this group. Some 500 to 1,500 people died in this melee, this chaos. And
well, hold that thought, because we're up against a hard break. And this is what set the table for your first book, correct? And these are all real events that happened. And so we're going to talk some more about this. We're talking with Ethan Burrows. He is the author of Messianic Reveal, Writ Reveal, and soon more to come. We'll be right back. This is Hope for the Caregiver.
He will be strong to deliver me safe, and the joy of the Lord is my strength.
Welcome back to Hope for the Caregiver. Here on American Family Radio, I am Peter Rosenberger, and we're glad that you're with us. You can go out to hopeforthecaregiver.com, hopeforthecaregiver.com. There's a little form there if you want to be a part of the program. You just fill it out. Send me a note. Tell me what's on your mind, what's on your heart, and we'd love to hear from you. That is my wife, Gracie, and Russ Taff from her CD, Resilient, and you can go out to hopeforthecaregiver.com and learn more about that. Get a hold of that CD for yourself. You've heard me say this often about how important it is to not put your life on hold as a caregiver. And we tend to do this at various times, thinking that, no, we'll do this later, we'll do this later. But sometimes just, you know, we get a moment of clarity where we realize, you know what, there later is not promised to us. Let's do what we need to do today, right now. And whether it's being a musician or pursuing this or whatever, within reason, as you navigate your journey. My guest today is Ethan Burrows. He is a novelist. He's an award-winning novelist. His first two books are already out. The third was coming out next year, and the fourth one will be out several years after that. He and I went from the same town, same high school, and he also has parents that are aging and dealing with some very serious realities. I don't share a whole lot of his background simply because I don't think we can. And you'll know more about that as we listen to him talk about these books. And so I'm being a little bit vague on that. But these books bring a great scope of history and a lot of the things that we see plastered in our media every day, but we don't know how to connect those dots. Well, he does. And he's one of the very, very few who've done the kind of work he's done for as long as he's done. And now he's actually taking time to write about it. And I don't know anybody that's done like you've done and written from somebody who's actually lived it. And he was sharing before we went to the break about what was going on in the connecting the dots with the Tehran. And then they had the cult that followed. So take us back into this and then share a little bit more about how you get into this. We're going to talk about how you wove your faith into these books and everything else. But take us back into that place in Tehran.
Okay, so yeah, in 1979, you had this hostile takeover of our embassy by a student uprising led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who had this glorious triumphant return to Iran from a year and a half, where he lived in Paris collecting political and financial support for his return. But 2 weeks later, and this is the footnote that no one seems to know about. I spent a lot of time in the Middle East. I spent a lot of time talking to very smart people, and collectively, no one seems to know a whole lot about this siege of Mecca. It happened 2 weeks after the takeover in Iran of our embassy. But this is a brutal, hostile, bloody melee where somewhere between 500 and 1,500 people died violently. And then the surviving militants, terrorists, messianic cult members, call them what you will, they were taken out by the Saudi authorities to 9 different cities around the country, summarily beheaded. Cover up. That's it. Now, as I started exploring this story and why no one seems to know much about it, I wondered if the two could be connected somehow. And Peter, I'm going to put you on the spot. You read my books. You know that Khomeini planned his return to Tehran from Paris. Do you know where he was before he was before Paris? Do you recall?
Before he was in Paris. I knew he was in Paris.
Yes.
Wasn't he in the United States?
No. You're thinking of Tehranjulis, where hundreds of thousands of Iranian exiles live. No, okay. He never came to the States. He was in southern Iraq. And this is what's important for
me. Oh, that's
right.
Yeah,
you remember now, yes. He was in southern Iraq, and the reason it's important, and I won't go into a lot of details because, you know, this is, well, I want people to read the book. But he was in southern Iraq, which is has the holiest sites of Shia Islam. And this is where it connects to U.S. intervention in the region. And I think it's very important for those of us who have served in the region or who have family members who have gone over and you know, given up of their time and in some cases, you know, paid the ultimate price for the intervention there. Ayatollah Khomeini spent 12 years in southern Iraq. He was there in cahoots with the Shia religious establishment. Most people think the Shia are in Iran. Yes, Iran is a majority Shia country, but so is Iraq. And Iraq has the holiest, like the Vatican for the Shia faith is there. And Saddam Hussein could not, who was from the Sunni community, could not have his arch nemesis in a powerful position next door in Iran, and taking with him the fealty and the loyalty of the Shia community in southern Iraq. And so, you know, I think that, again, if you want to look at it from the military perspective, we kind of stepped into this sectarian conflict that was spread out from Saudi Arabia through Iraq and into Iran, without knowing a whole lot about that and why that matters and why the stronghold of Shia Islam is in southern Iraq.
So, now, wait a minute, we bolstered up Saddam Hussein to push him against the Ayatollah Khomeini.
That's right.
And that set the table for what happened 30-something years later. It's still going on.
Well, let me rewind it a little bit. The very same things that the cult members, the messianic cult members, the claims that they were demanding when they took over the Vatican of the Islamic world in Mecca was repeated verbatim by a guy of the name Osama bin Laden in 1989. So the siege of Mecca happened in 1979 when Osama bin Laden starts his Al-Qaeda, the foundation, the terrorist group that we know as Al-Qaeda, or at the South we say Al-Qaeda. When he started that, he was using the exact same terminology and verbiage and rhetoric that the messianic cult used 10 years before. And his older half-brother was part of that cult. And that's 100% true. I told you the terrifying parts are all true.
I know. And as I was reading this, I realized that is the foundation of where you start in this book with all of the stuff that none of us knew. The United States remained clueless about, for the most part, except some people in the intelligence agency, and nobody was really connecting those dots because intelligence during a lot of this time was kind of segmented, correct?
Well, yeah, I use the word silo for a reason, and I'm not here to make, you know, to cast aspersions on, how intelligence was collected, but I do know that it's more convenient to compartmentalize things. And I would argue that you need a fuller picture if you're going to understand the region and why it matters to us. It matters to us because our interventions drum up a great deal of antagonism and antipathy toward the United States. And yet, you know, we kind of need some of these countries when it comes to our energy needs. We need some of these countries when we want them. Go ahead.
Well, you think about all the blood and treasure that we have spilled into that region and how many people really know nothing about what's going on.
Yeah.
And we're going because these people in Washington sat around a table and said, we got to do this. And nobody's knowing the history of what's going on with these people, what kind of fight we're stepping into. And I look at, you know, I think Gracie and I were there at Walter Reed right at the beginning of the Iraq and Afghanistan war and all that was going on. And we saw all these guys coming back, just horrific wounds. And still, nobody really knows what's going on here. What are we trying to accomplish here? What are we stepping into? And so your book has unpacked all of this. Yes, you've said it as a spy thriller novel, but the way you've done this is what's been so breathtaking for me because I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? It's like there's a point where I started turning pages and saying, are you kidding me? Every page. And then that's when I called you. I said, which part of this is true? And that's when I was like, oh my goodness. So it was, and then I love how you made this protagonist, just this, you know, a guy with strong Christian faith from South Carolina, very much kind of like what you grew up doing. And you were thrust into this and trying to learn this and keep up with this the whole time. And it's, you know, it's, now, there are parts of the book that are fairly violent.
Yes. Well, but I can say I've certainly been targeted myself. I've had an office blown up. I've had to, and I'm sorry to say this on the air, but I've had to clean up body parts. You know, some of the things that we've seen and been a part of has not been pretty. And you know, our soldiers are coming back and, you know, I have family members, you have family members, I'm sure, who have served over in places like that. They've come back and, you know, and you referenced, you know, my own Christian background and my protagonist, my books are not overtly Christian. They're not, you know, I think if I want to do an honest approach to the intersection of faith and politics, I needed to establish some bona fides. And so I chose to have my character, is a practicing Christian, and he finds himself in the heartland of Islam.
Yeah, it's like you just kind of threw him into it.
Yes.
And he's got to play catch up with things that he just had no idea. And it tests his faith, but he comes through it. I mean, he's not broken in this. He doesn't walk away from it. It actually deepens his understanding on some things. And I was really impressed by the way the character developed through this because it gave him insight that he just didn't have.
Well, you know, I think he may have started like so many of us where, you know, based on the assumption there's good and evil. And I'm hoping I'm not testing your theology or even my own or any of your listeners. I would say that that's a convenient label, good and evil, because at the other end, he finds good people whose faiths, which differ from his, but good people whose faiths are exploited by despotic rulers or you know, the spoilers, the villains in the book. And again, the villains I use are based on real people.
Well, and I think we see that in pretty much everywhere. There are always people that are manipulated by these things. And that's a tragedy that we as Christians hang our heads in shame because we've seen it. And some of the great people of our faith have gone to a wooden stake and were burned at the stake because of people who said they were doing this in the name of God. Our Savior was crucified in the name of God. So there's a lengthy history. It's the human condition of people being manipulated by religion. I love how you are bringing a whole new component of revealing this to people and showing them things that they never saw before. We're talking with award-winning author Ethan Burroughs, and he has a series of books he's done, Messianic Reveal, Writ Revealed, and more coming as well, and you're going to want to check these out. EthanBurroughs.com. EthanBurroughs.com. We're going to talk more with him when we come back. Don't go away. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is Hope for the Caregiver. We'll be right back. I'm Peter Rosenberger, and many years ago when my wife Gracie became a double amputee, she saw the importance of quality prosthetics. She saw the importance of a support team and people that could help her regain her life after losing both legs. And she had this vision of creating an organization that would help others do the very same thing while pointing them to Christ. And for more than 17 years, we've been doing just that. We purchase supplies, we send equipment, and we train and we send teams over to West Africa. We've been working with the country of Ghana, several clinics over there now. And each week, more people walk because of Gracie's vision. In 2011, we launched a new program outreach to family caregivers. Drawing on my now 36 plus years as Gracie's caregiver through a medical nightmare, I offer insights I've learned, all of it the hard way, to fellow caregivers to help them stay strong and healthy while taking care of someone who is not. If you want to be a part of this, go out to standingwithhope.com/giving. standingwithhope.com/giving. Help us do more. At Standing With Hope, we're reaching the wounded and those who care for them. standingwithhope.com/giving.
Take my hand, lean on me, we will stay.
Welcome back to the program. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is Hope for the Caregiver here on American Family Radio. And we're glad that you are with us. HopeForTheCaregiver.com. And as I said, sometimes I like to talk to caregivers who are doing things in the midst of their caregiving, things that I think are extraordinary, such as the case with my guest today, Ethan Burroughs. EthanBurroughs.com. We've known each other forever from the same state, same high school. And he has a series of books that he's done that are just amazing thriller novels, but there's more to it than that. And of course, he's going through some caregiving issues of his own. I have to be a bit vague on some of these things, and you'll just have to trust me on it, but I can't share a lot of who he is and his family, and so I'm being a bit vague, but he's there. I want to depart just a hair before we get back into more of your stuff. As a novelist, I'm a writer. I mean, I've written several books, but my stuff's not fiction. I mean, and I'm not doing that. You're very creative in what you've done. And one of the things I've encouraged people on this program to do is really explore whatever can give, you know, release to the whatever's going on in their soul. Caregiving can be a pressure cooker, and it causes a lot of deep feelings, and it feels kind of claustrophobic in your heart. And I've encouraged people to find those things that give that release. You found, you know, something in your heart that expresses this through writing these great stories. What advice would you give to people who want to write, who feel like they have a story they want to tell, they're not sure how to go about it or where to even start? What advice would you give?
Well, let me first say I've read all of your books as well, and I think the thing that sticks out to me from your books is, one, is how sadly real they are. And I know you write from a great deal of pain, but they're also pretty funny. And I think you have you and Mr. T share a PhD in pain and suffering. And I think you will admit is probably a coping mechanism, but whatever it takes, you know, right. Yeah. You have to grab onto that hope and that you're always standing with, right? But what the advice, you know, if people are thinking about writing, I'd first start with your motives. one, if you're writing to be rich and famous, don't, you know, try out for the NBA instead. If you write because you have a story, I write because I have a story. I have a wonderful story. It's compelling. I can't not write. And I love sharing the story with people. I like to see their reactions. And I'd say that, you know, if you have a story, you need to write. You just carve out some time, turn off Netflix and write. But don't do it for the wrong reasons. Don't do it so you can be a role model. We have enough role models. You either write because you have a compelling story, or whatever. It doesn't have to be writing. Whatever helps you communicate your message. If you're trying to bolster and build up a community, or connect with people, inform people like you do, Peter. There's an element of entertaining, but there's also
it's a very strong small element at times. sometimes that's a very small element.
Yeah, but I mean, there's not a lot of fun in your background. I mean, your expertise does not lend itself to a lot of entertainment value and a lot of fun. I know you've gone through some dark days, but you take that darkness and you use it to transitive verb inform people. And I think that that's what's key. You have a story to tell and you can't not tell it.
Well, I had I was talking to a lady today that her son just died after she'd been taking care of him for 36 years. He had a lot of issues going on in his life and significant disabilities. Developmental, he was blind, a lot of things. And she was talking about writing his story. And I thought, well, I asked her, I said, well, how about writing your story? Because yeah. I think that would be something that people wanted, because we all have a story in us. And I think it's so easy to write about somebody else's story. But this is, in many respects, this book, series of books he's read, this is your story. This is what you want to, like you said in the first block, you wanted to pass on to your children of understanding why they were raised in this environment, what this means, how this all fits. And it's your story. And I think that for all of the listeners to this program, all my fellow caregivers, you know, you have a story. And like, I love what you said. Don't try to do this to write a hit novel and become rich and famous as a writer. Do it because it's authentic to who you are. Yeah. And if there's one thing I have come to treasure about your books, it's that it is authentic. They're real. And the way you describe the people, you help people get to know, not like you did with our mutual missionary friends over there, helping them integrate into that community so that they can better connect and relate. It's so important not to just parachute in and start just yelling at people and preaching at people versus just getting to know them. And this is what you've done in your entire career. You've gotten to know people. You've spent times on the streets and the bazaars and all these things you do. What is something about the Middle East that you would like people to know that they may not know here in the West?
I would say just right off that the people of the Middle East want the same things we want. They want, you know, good, stable, they want prosperity. They want a good, stable environment to raise their children and, you know, raise their families. They want educational opportunities for their sons and their daughters. And they want, you know, they want a voice in their community. Exactly the same things that we want. Exactly the same things. They just have a great many impediments that we don't have. And some of those are governmental. Many of those are cultural. Many of those are religious. And that's one of the things, if you allow me, writ reveal, I took in a different direction. While I was studying and researching for Messianic reveal, I came across a study in 1972 by German scientists in Yemen, and they basically had old parchments, old Quranic parchments that were written. This was bits of the Quran, and they determined that these bits of the Quran were written before Muhammad had his visions from the angel Gabriel. Or Jibril, as they say in Arabic.
By the way, that could get you in a lot of trouble for saying that, can't it?
Absolutely.
That's why I have to be kind of vague about some things with you.
Well, you know, the thing is, I don't shy away from talking, going right to the heart of the matter. But I want to be very careful. I'm going to be very clear. I do not say anything in any of my books that denigrate the people of any faith. I'm not out to do that. I'm not out to say this faith is right, this faith is wrong. I mean, certainly, I think Presbyterians have something over the Episcopalians, and you know, but I'm not going to say, I'm not going to put one faith over another. I don't do that. I do not attack faith. I do not attack people. I attack the people who distort and twist and manipulate the faith of others. That is what I do in these books, and I do it head on. Absolutely. And I've had Muslim friends read my books to verify that I don't do anything that outrage. In fact, they come back and they say, I've learned so much about my faith and my history. And
wow.
I tell you what, I find that the highest compliment when I've had Muslim friends come back to me and say, I learned so much about my faith and my history, because so much of it is whitewashed. And dare I say, sometimes in our own communities here in the States, there might be a little bit of that too, from time to time.
Oh, I've seen interpretation. I've seen it where we just kind of, we've done this in our own Christian faith. There's a lot of pulpits out there that that spin things that are not accurate. And
right.
People follow along out of sincerity and devoutness, but they don't know.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it's interesting that Jesus said in Matthew 28, he said, go ye therefore in all the world. He didn't say go out there and get everybody saved. He said, go out there, share the good news and make disciples. Teach them. Teach them. Yeah. That's what making disciples, teach them. And the fact that that you're helping people have a greater understanding. You can't just go into people's lives and just start, like you said, just start holding them down and preaching at them. You have to learn who they are and speak to them and translate and communicate with them in a way that both of you can understand. And you've given amazing tools in this in these series of books that you're doing of people, of a culture, of a world that that the West really has very little understanding of.
Sadly. You're right, but yet that is a culture that gave us our faith, our mathematics, our science, our, you know, there's so much of our enlightenment came from that very region. And one of the things I like to point out, most of my first three books all largely take place in Iraq, and not because I have this deep, it's because I have a deep fascination with Iraq, mainly because after Israel, Iraq is the second most mentioned country or country that we identify under current geography in the Bible. Iraq plays a critical role. Abraham, of course, is from Iraq, and I won't go through all of the prophets who come from Iraq, but it's a huge list. And I say, just very quick, Babylon Reveal, my third book, it explores from a political and secular angle the simple question of why does God hate Babylon so much? And I dare to answer that question, and it will blow your mind.
I haven't seen this one, by the way. I haven't read this book.
I'm holding that to the end of July for you.
Okay. Well, I thank you for that. Well, I really have enjoyed this, and I've enjoyed the process of you that you've shared behind the scenes with me of this journey. And I remember when you started doing it, and I was thinking, okay, how's this going to work? But it's turned out to be so much more. You've had an opportunity now to engage with quite a few people in this, and you've raised more than a few eyebrows because you're saying things that no one has ever said. Not that I've ever seen. I don't see it in the news, and I'm a news junkie and so forth. So we're going to have, when this new one comes out, we'll have you back on. We'll talk about this some more. I think it's just a fascinating journey into someone who's not putting their life on hold, doing it right now. And I want you to know, Ethan, how much I appreciate you taking the time on this today.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you, for having me on the air, but also for what you're doing. I know you're inspiring, you're touching the lives of thousands, literally tens of thousands of people on a regular basis. And I just, as someone who's been touched, who's followed you, who's read your books, who's listened to your broadcast, I really appreciate it.
You bet. You're quite welcome. EthanBurroughs.com, BURROUGHS, EthanBurroughs.com. Get a copy of this book. Give it to a friend. It's a great gift. This is Peter Rosenberger. We'll see you next time.